And for the past few times, we've had a lot of stories. In fact, since chapter 4, there's been a lot of stories of miracles and of healings. And it's been great, hasn't it? All right. Thanks, Colin. Well, this one's going to be a little bit different. Sorry. Not that it's not going to be great, but just it's a bit different. Today is we're going to be looking at Mark chapter 7. So if you don't have a Bible, I suggest you get one. So what I'm going to be doing is going through this passage bit by bit. So we're not going to have one long reading at the beginning. So it would be really great if you get a Bible. If you haven't got one, do you want to just stick up your hand and the hospitality team or some lovely person will place a Bible into your hand? So it looks like Mark was written primarily to non-Jews, as he does a lot of explanation of Jewish customs and practices, which is something that a first century Jew wouldn't have needed. And so this makes it a little bit easier for us to understand the context, and it made it a whole lot easier for me to write this talk. So we're going to be looking at Mark chapter 7 from verse 1, which is on page 954 in the church Bibles. If you have a stolen Gideon Bible, I've got no idea which page that would be. The Pharisees and some of the teachers of the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered round Jesus and saw some of his disciples eating food with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. The Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they give their hands a ceremonial washing, holding to the tradition of the elders. When they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And they observe many other traditions, such as the washing of cups, pitchers, and kettles. So the Pharisees and the teachers of the law asked Jesus, "Why don't your disciples live according to the tradition of the elders instead of eating their food with defiled hands?" Here's the first of these traditions, the washing of hands. They aren't just talking about cleaning the dirt off their hands before eating. This isn't a hygiene issue. It's about being ceremonially clean. It's an issue of purity. In the marketplace, they may have come into contact with a Gentile, therefore being made unclean. Unfortunately, the Pharisees' idea of purity was all about looking good rather than being good. Jesus talks elsewhere about the way that they would pray loudly, make a big show of giving money to the temple, and they would make their faces all messed up when they were fasting. This is so other people would see that they were holy. Let's continue. He replied, "Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you hypocrites, as it is written, 'These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain. Their teachings are merely human rules. You have let go of the commands of God and are holding on to human traditions.'" In Exodus, Moses is not only given the introduction to the law, which is the Ten Commandments, but also 603 other laws for the Israelites to follow in order for them to be God's treasured possession and a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. This was the covenant, a legal agreement between God and his people that they were required to obey. Jesus summarizes all these laws in Mark 12 as love God and love others. But because there were so many laws, the Pharisees came up with a load of additional rules to act as a buffer, to protect the people from the law and the law from people. I personally think that they started out with good intentions, but that over time, their rules got stricter and they became as high or maybe even higher than the Mosaic laws. The law that God had given to Moses also acted as a mirror, showing the Israelites how much they really needed God and how far they fell short of the standard that God required. The problem with adding these human rules is precisely that. They're human, full of flaws, weakness, fallibility, and imperfection. It opened up the redefinition of purity by human standards rather than by God's. After generations of these oral laws being passed down, the focus became more on, am I meeting my own standards, rather than, am I meeting God's standard? Rather than love God and love others, it became more about doing things to look good, to make sure that the human standard of purity, which was really focused on the outward appearance, were being met. Jesus grabs hold of another one of these human rules in verse 9. And he continued, "You have a fine way of setting aside the commands of God in order to observe your own traditions. For Moses said, 'Honor your father and mother,' and 'Anyone who curses their father or mother is to be put to death.' But you say that if anyone declares that what might have been used to help their father or mother is korban, that is, devoted to God, then you no longer let them do anything for their father or mother. Thus, you nullify the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down. And you do many things like that." This takes it to a whole new level. Not only had they been redefining purity by their own standards, but they used their own rules to negate God's. I love the way that Jesus doesn't directly answer the Pharisees' original question, but gets straight to the heart of the core issue. What does it mean to be good, to be pure? Jesus calls them hypocrites because they were teaching their own rules, as if they were teaching God's truth. The result of this problem is really highlighted in Jesus' example, where he shows them how their rules had tried to find a loophole in two of God's commands. By the human standard of purity, though, they were fine. But by God's, they weren't. The bigger picture behind the law has always been to bring God's people closer to him. God has always desired to be in relationship with us, but our sin gets in the way. He gave the law to set a standard of purity and holiness, but at the same time to show us that we could never do it on our own. Verse 14, I'm just going to go straight to the end now. Again, Jesus called the crowd to him and said, "Listen to me, everyone, and understand this. Nothing outside you can defile you by going into you. Rather, it is what comes out of you that defiles you." After he had left the crowd and entered the house, his disciples asked him about this parable. "Are you so dull?" he asked. "Don't you see that nothing that enters you from the outside can defile you? For it doesn't go into your heart, but into your stomach, and then out of your body." In saying this, Jesus declared all foods clean. He went on, "What comes out of you is what defiles you. For from within, out of your hearts, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from inside and defile you." What comes out of you defiles you. Jesus here is saying that the food you eat, the way that you wash your hands, whether or not you even wash your hands before eating, won't affect how pure you are. The Pharisees have got too hung up on the letter of the law and their own rules, and therefore focusing on outward purity to see what the real point was. The purity of the human heart. Just to clarify, when Jesus talks about the heart, he's meaning the place in us where our motives come from, not the big red thing that pumps blood around. Jesus here is saying it's the condition of what's inside you that makes you pure, not what you look like on the outside. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus took the law to a whole new level, applying it to the thoughts and intentions of the heart. Murder is not the issue. Anger is. Adultery is not the issue. Lust is. Stealing isn't the issue. Envy is. I wonder how the disciples felt after hearing that. Flippin' heck, JC. I was finding it hard enough to keep the Big Ten, let alone the other 300-odd laws. Now you drop this on us too? This is impossible. If I was reading this for the first time, and without knowing Jesus as my mate, I'd almost expect him to come out with some meditation guide on how to cleanse your soul in 5 easy steps, and to tell his disciples to get in touch with their truest, deepest feelings. But the problem would be this. What if the deep feeling that truly expresses who I am right now is murderous? I didn't mean to catch your eye. Sorry, Andy. I'll do this one for the next one. What about if it's lustful, just so that this... or envious? Just because the feeling is in my heart doesn't validate it. It doesn't mean that it's right. What it does do is highlight that my heart has a major problem. This isn't just cosmetic damage to my heart. This is structural catastrophe with a big sign saying, "Do not enter." So what now? Jesus has just identified the big problem, the massive issue of the impurity of the heart. The disciples knew, and we know, that we can't change our own hearts. It all seems a bit hopeless. This is the end of the passage. This is where Jesus leaves it. Thankfully, we do know the rest of the story. Jesus said that he came to fulfill the law, not to abolish it. And in Galatians 3:24, it says, "The law was put in charge to lead us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith." The law pointed out our sinfulness. It proved our inability to keep our end of the covenant and showed us our need for a Savior. In Hebrews 7, it says, "The old law was set aside because it was weak and useless, for the law made nothing perfect." You see, the law had no way of changing our sinful nature, no way of fixing our hearts. We needed something better to accomplish that. Along with the sins of generations past, present, and future, Jesus took the structural catastrophe of our hearts to the cross. That big sign on the construction site of our hearts saying, "Do not enter," was taken down, and God could begin fixing. Tom Wright says, he's a theologian, he's a cool guy, "Everything the scriptures were getting at reached a peak in Jesus Christ. The laws aren't to be seen as a timeless code of behavior, but as a story that leads to Jesus. When you arrive at the destination, you don't need the signposts anymore. Not because they were worthless, but precisely because they were correct." The annoying thing for the Pharisees is that all this looking good business was for nothing. Justification, being made right with God, being holy and pure, was now a free gift, open to all. It's open to us. Of course, our hearts aren't made pure overnight. Just like constructing a building, it takes time. But God has promised that he will bring to completion the good work that he started in you and in me. It's his job to fix our hearts, not ours. But we still go with our daddy to the construction site. Do you want to stand? Yeah, can we have the band up? Cheers, Andy. We're just going to, I know we've got a lot of time, and that's okay. We're just going to wait. You might find it helpful to close your eyes. You might find it helpful to stick out your hands. I'd guess that most of us aren't in a place where we could say our hearts are perfectly fine and pure, that we require no fixing. But I wonder whether there's a few of us here today that you really feel like your heart is a catastrophe. Maybe you feel trapped by something that's going on in your life. Maybe you just feel hopeless. If you really feel like your heart is just in a really bad place at the moment, maybe you've still got the Do Not Enter sign up. Maybe you've let God in a little bit but you've put the barrier tape around some of the more destroyed parts. I wonder if you'd do something really, really brave. Just put up your hand. And we're just going to wait. It's God who does this business, not us. Spirit, would you come to those of us who have our hands up, where our hearts just feel a mess? God, would you come?